Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 13, 2018. This is the Week 2 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on Shamatha Vipassana meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
I'd just like to get a feel for where we are as a Sangha going through the course. So has everyone read the chapter on Shamatha Vipassana? Did anyone listen to either the Tuesday or the Thursday talks this week? How many? Okay. So now I can repeat myself. My talk is going to be slightly different than it was Tuesday and Thursday, just to talk about something additionally. Let me start with the Buddha's words. Whatever is to be done by a teacher with compassion for the welfare of students, that has been done by me out of compassion for you. Wonderful words, isn't it? He's defining the reason why he taught. Here are the roots of trees. Here are empty places. Go and meditate. Don't be lazy. Don't become one who is later remorseful. This is my instruction to you. Pretty direct. Remembering that it's coming from an awakened human being has a lot of force and power behind it, doesn't it? And it's like all of the Buddhist teachings. It is direct and it's very simple and very plain. And the Buddha's overall teachings are very unambiguous. They all get to the point when we understand the proper context. And that relates now to why we're meditating. I talked a little bit about that earlier. We meditate to develop concentration. And so why is concentration important anyway? Why do we care? If we're trying to go from an unawakened or immature state, why would we care about developing a well-concentrated mind? Why can't we keep the distracted mind that we've had our whole life? It's done us okay, hasn't it? It's gotten us here. Well, there's an underlying reason why each and every one of us is here, isn't it? We feel that there's something missing out of our life, or we don't quite understand the purpose of being here, or we've suffered tragedies that don't seem to make sense. These are the same things that set the Buddha out on his search for understanding. He saw the general unsatisfactoriness of life in human life. He saw that this is finite, that we get X number of years, that nobody knows how many there are, and we're dead. And he tried to make some sense out of this. Now remember, the Buddha was a prince in his father's kingdom. He had everything that anybody could ever want. And even having everything that anybody could ever want, he still found that life was lacking. So already he had an insight into gaining power, prestige, or things was not the answer because it didn't satisfy him. And then when he went out into the world and saw the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of most everyone, it shocked him. Why are we like this? Why do we have such the three defilements? Why would we have such greed? Why do we have such aversion to things that naturally arise? Why do we have such confused thinking? What happened? As the Buddha studied these things over the period of 6 years, he came to an understanding that all of our self-inflicted problems are rooted in ignorance, in a very specific ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths, another way of saying Four Noble Truths is simply the way things are, the way things really are. And so he taught an eightfold path to develop an understanding of ignorance so that we could abandon our own contributions to our own ignorance, develop wisdom. The Eightfold Path is rooted in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, in deepening concentration, so that we can recognize that distracted mind that's rooted in ignorance. That all makes sense, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm explaining this in a way that makes sense to you. Yeah. The Buddha describes in the Arahant Sutta, the Arahant Sutta is a sutta that I've subtitled Awakening in a Single Paragraph, because he describes awakening in a single paragraph. And he closes that very short, concise sutta by saying, now I can't remember it. In short, It is the arising and the passing away of five clinging aggregates. And understanding the arising and the passing away of five clinging aggregates, that leads to awakening. I'm paraphrasing it slightly. So it's understanding the five clinging aggregates that is the goal or the topic, isn't it? And we don't have to always address five clinging aggregates. We don't have to keep it in our mind. But to understand, the five clinging aggregates are form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. Understanding the arising and the passing away of the five clinging aggregates is awakening. So how does that relate, and why is meditation important in developing that? The first aggregate, form, is our physical form. Again, there's nothing ambiguous or difficult to understand about this, except these are unfamiliar terms and unfamiliar in the way that we use them to relate to a self. The first aggregate is form, the form aggregate. We're physical beings, aren't we? We should recognize that we're physical beings, but we should recognize it without attaching ourselves as a substantial, fixed-in-place, physical, permanent being. Form is impermanent. It's constantly impermanent. It's not just impermanent at death that it changes. It changes every single moment of our life. And physicists have found something, and this is not just recently, but something that the Buddha knew 2,600 years ago, that the body changes every single moment. There's cells that come into existence and blink out of existence every single... That's how the body is maintained. That's how the health of the body up until a certain point is maintained, by cells arising and cells passing away. Disease cells passing away and healthy cells arising until a certain point. Form is impermanent. Feelings make up who we are, don't we? We often describe ourselves by how we feel, don't we? That's our description of ourselves. How are you doing today? Oh, I'm okay. Well, I'm not okay. Especially if we're looking for sympathy. We want to put a little bit of a game on. Carry a long face so people will notice us a little more. What's the matter with you? I'm feeling blah, blah, blah. We describe ourselves by our feelings, don't we? But the feeling we're using to describe ourselves in a personal and permanent way is itself impermanent. Why hang on to the feeling? Why describe ourselves by our feelings? Except we do. From a misunderstanding of the way things are, we create perceptions based on our feelings. I'm feeling good, so I'm having a good day. My perception is that I've just had a good day because I felt good all day. Or the perception that I had a lousy day because I didn't feel good all day. It's all based on impermanence, isn't it? Why describe our day or our life by how we feel? The feeling itself is impermanent. Why hang on to it? Again, do you see the self-reference to impermanent feelings? Form, feeling, perceptions. Mental fabrications. Now, in dependent origination, the Buddha teaches that is from ignorance. As a requisite condition come fabrications, mental fabrications. Ignorance is required for mental fabrications to develop and affect our lives. So the fourth aggregate is that fabrications. Fabrications are assumptions we've made about ourselves and the world we live in based on ignorance. Yet, we live our lives based on those assumptions, don't we? If the assumptions themselves are rooted in ignorance, shouldn't we abandon the ignorance? Yes, how do we do that through the Eightfold Path? The fifth clinging aggregate is consciousness. Now, this is not consciousness with a big C. It's not a grand cosmic consciousness. It's simply ongoing thinking rooted in that initial ignorance. And these five aggregates are what we cling together in our own mind to describe the personal experience of suffering. When the Buddha described suffering, and he did it right in his very first teaching and then hundreds of times throughout his teaching career, he described it as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Getting what is undesired, receiving what is undesired is suffering. Not getting what we want is suffering. That's a general explanation of suffering. And then he always concluded that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. So again, I don't mean this class to be on the five clinging aggregates. We're going to get into that in weeks 7 or 8 or 9. But just to point out that the reason why we meditate is to deepen concentration so that we can understand, so our minds are settled enough to recognize what we're doing to ourselves. that we're making something out of nothing. We're describing an entire life based on how we feel. Or the thoughts, excuse the stutter, the thoughts related to how we feel. And that becomes the ongoing distraction and ongoing unsatisfactory nature of life because those descriptions of ourselves are rooted in ignorance of the way things are. When we finally understand the impermanence of all things, we'll stop using impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas to describe ourselves to ourselves. As the Buddha describes, it's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing behind it. That's not to say that there's nothing there, that there's nothing to a self. That's not a teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha never taught emptiness as in all things are empty, or there's no such thing, or nothingness is something to aspire to. He taught that it is a misunderstanding of self that leads to all confusion. That's a big difference between teaching that there's a misunderstanding of self and that there's no such thing as a self, isn't there? The way that we can use a misunderstanding of self as a way of annihilating the self is simply a way of denying who we are, isn't it? Well, I don't even have to concern myself with the problems that I'm having because I'm not really here. That's not what the Buddha taught. That's just another false idea that we create to allow ourselves to continue to ignore our own ignorance. As we deepen our concentration and we start developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path, which is where we're at right now, we're building the foundation in this chapter, we recognize the impermanence of all things. We recognize that what's most important is to be mindfully present with our life as life occurs without the need for it to be any different. That's the secret to life. Another way of saying that is to find meaning in every single thing that occurs without having self-reference be part of that meaning. Things are meaningful because they're occurring, period. Not because I like them or dislike them, not because life has gotten my attention, or it hasn't, or it's boring. Some of the great philosophers have said life is its own answer, but they didn't understand the question behind it. Well, why is it so unsatisfactory at times? It's because I need it to be different. And that really is the secret to happiness. Can I accept in a radical way, meaning without any equivocation, whatever that word is, without any need for it to be any difference, can I accept what's going on? And then most importantly, when we can start doing that internally, then we can do it externally. And that's where real compassion comes from, doesn't it? Because I've learned the nature of my own suffering to such a profound level. The Buddha described right view or understanding as understanding at a penetrative level the nature of suffering. When I can do that first with myself, but I can also use the world as an example as I'm developing this, when I can understand my own suffering and my own contributions to suffering, then I can truly understand the nature of the suffering in the world. That's exactly how the Buddha awakened. He didn't come to any conclusions, and I've recently been thinking about this. There was something in Siddhartha Gautama that allowed him to become awakened before anyone else. Why was Siddhartha the first one? And a speculation on my part, because he didn't have a complete veil of ignorance. In other words, his thinking wasn't completely shrouded by wrong views. And that question that he had when he first left the palace grounds and walked through town, where does this come from? Why is this such an unsatisfactory experience? Why couldn't it be another way? Why couldn't everything just be perfect the way it is? Why do we struggle? Why do we have the three defilements of greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking? It's because we want things to be different than we are. And so perhaps the only difference in Siddhartha and everyone else is he realized the significance of even that question. Why do I need things to be different than they are? They can't be. And when we finally understand that at a profound level, we fully accept it because we accept things as they are because that's how they are. We learn the significant difference between acceptance and approval. A mind conditioned to attaching itself to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas must insist on approving every one of those thoughts, events, and ideas, right? If I'm identifying with this, I have to approve of it in some way or disapprove of it. This is not me. This is not mine. But in a broader sense, we recognize that when we stop taking things personal, we stop that self-identification with things. Things are just are. We don't see ourselves in it. It's the essence of anatta, the essence of self-identification. So that's enough of an introduction. I've gone far past Shamatha Vipassana meditation, the chapter itself. But again, just to lay the foundation for what we're doing over the next 11, 12, 13 weeks. So now I'd like to hear how you've been. Most of you have been coming for quite a while, except Scott. How you've been integrating Shamatha Vipassana meditation, how you've noticed an increase in concentration, and maybe whatever benefits you take off your cushion, and how you see the Shamatha Vipassana meditation or the concentration develop as the foundation for developing the broader framework or being mindful of the Eightfold Path, or whatever else you want to talk about, as long as it's not related. Kevin, it's good to see you this morning.
Nice to see you, John. Thanks for waiting a minute while I was late today. Nice to see you made it this morning. The meditation practice has been fairly consistent and integrated for longer than I can really remember now. Yeah. But I think it's about minimum 15 minutes, sometimes up to 30, always in the morning, and working on that second sit, tying it down. But I'll always sit in the morning. Sometimes I'll do 15 minutes just because, you know, might be running behind or, you know, that extra 10 minutes. But always 15. Trying to get to more 20 to 30 now. The concentration that I've noticed, it's hard to identify it, but when I'm with others, sometimes we'll all be talking, or groups will be talking, family will be talking, and everybody gets excited when we talk, and I don't know, I'm like, what were we just talking about? And it seems like I'm like the go-to guy, because if I just sit and practice restraint and don't follow the thought, maybe a breath or two later, I'll say, oh, we were talking about this. Yeah. Like, oh, thanks. And then we go back. And it's just, I guess that's an example of the concentration. I've surprised myself. I was like, wow, I just stopped. I can think about what I was thinking about or what I was talking about. So that's how it's worked, I guess.
A very practical example. Thank you. Yeah, as you know, that second sit is important. It's very beneficial. I can't think of anyone who hasn't said, once they've integrated that second sit, how important it was. Even I've had students, online students too, I don't think anybody here, that they say something like, well, I've been meditating for 25 years or 30 years, but only one sit. And the difference it made when they started that second sit later in the day. It really is important. Well, 1 second, Diane. And what I suggested to especially people that have developed a meditation practice but only one sit, to don't think that if you're going to introduce a second sit that it has to be as long as your first sit. That if you're sitting in the morning for 15 or 20 minutes, that your second sit has to be that long. You can start the second sit just like we started meditation, with short periods of meditation, 2 or 3 minutes. And I think you'll find almost immediately the benefit of that. It's just a nice balance. You know, 2 sits a day around 12 hours apart is a nice balance in a 24-hour period, and it really makes a difference. Diane?
Wow. If you said that before, I probably was spacing out somewhere. But one of the things that I have trouble with the second sit for, sometimes so much comes up in the first sit that I recognize, I mean, I can feel it coming up later after the sit, later on in the day, and I think, oh, I just do not want to sit again and have more stuff to come. And then I get into the syndrome of, well, maybe if you did the second sit, it would dissipate the stuff of the first sit. And I do all this kind of mental gymnastics, gyrations around the second sit. And I never really even thought of just starting with 2 minutes and calling it good for the second sit.
Yep, and then just build on that.
But why do you say that it's the second sit? That could be a tongue. The second sit is important. Why do you say that?
because meditation itself is important. Well, and the more that we can do that, and I'm not saying we should meditate for 24 hours a day, but the more that we can do that realistically through the middle way, through a balanced life, obviously the benefits are there. And to address something else that you said, because you may have had a lot of stuff come up during an initial sit, the first sit during the day, and thinking that may affect, or that same stuff might come up in another sit, is simply aversion. It's there to be recognized as that. And remembering the five hindrances, you simply sit, no matter what's arising. And even if I've had let me say this another way. No matter what comes up during meditation, we come back to the sensation of breathing. In so doing, we recognize the impermanence of even something that is recurring. And during meditation, where we don't have any expectations except developing and utilizing the method, then we can leave our meditation sessions as they are. We don't have to let one influence the next. Whatever comes up during meditation is what comes up. When we take our last breath in meditation and come out of meditation, we're done with our meditation. Doesn't mean we shouldn't consider what's occurred, but certainly don't allow it to influence a second sit. That second sit is so important. It's a very subtle thing. And I would say it's impossible to completely get away from wanting meditation to be a certain way, to have a certain effect, to feel good during it or afterwards. But that all relates to the five clinging aggregates, doesn't it? How I feel during meditation or how I feel afterwards. That feeling itself is impermanent, even though it might persist. So don't allow your feelings, don't allow the results, don't allow anything to affect your meditation practice. Save for the right method and the right framework. And in so doing, then every meditation session will be seen as skillful or effective because we've engaged in the right method. So something I mentioned Tuesday night, because the focus is on the breath, Shamatha Vipassana meditation, the focus is on the breath, being mindful of the breath, we tend to get frustrated when we find ourselves caught up in our thoughts again, don't we?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
And that frustration is rooted in a self-referential view, isn't it? I'm doing this wrong, or it's not progressing quick enough, or whatever the thought might be. But every time that we find that we're caught up in our thinking again, or recognize that we're caught up in our thinking again, or acknowledge that we're caught up in our thinking again, and come back to the sensation of breathing, we're deepening concentration. So recognizing that we're caught up in our thinking again is a component of that, isn't it? It's just as important to recognize it as it is to abandon it and come back to the sensation of breathing. And if it wasn't for that part of it, there'd be no way to increase concentration, would it? We're conscious beings. Thought should be flowing. Feelings and thoughts should be arising and passing away. Meditation, there is some meditation, in fact most meditations are kind of taught or inferred that you meditate to develop a blank mind, to have a trance-like state. That's the farthest from what the Buddha taught as anything else. It's just foolish. And I could teach you all in about 5 minutes a technique that you would be in a trance-like state. I don't do it because for one thing I think it'd be cruel to do, but it's completely useless. Feelings and thoughts arise. As conscious and sensitive beings, they're supposed to arise. Feelings and thoughts arising and passing away do not occur in a dead person. We're not dead. We're alive. Feelings and thoughts arise and pass away, just like our breath arises and passes away. That's why it's such a practical metaphor for impermanence, being mindful of the breath arising and passing away. So any meditation method, any meditation session that we find that we have to continually keep coming back to our breath is a very successful and skillful meditation session because we're deepening our concentration that way. Thank you, Diane, for the inspiration for that long, another talk. Jen, I'm sorry. Good to see you.
I guess in terms of your original question, the last couple of months, I feel like definitely there's judgment going on with regard to my meditation practice, and
I always do two sits, but sometimes the morning sit doesn't happen, and sometimes it's like really short. I go through periods where I'm generally like very resistant to meditating at all, but I'll do it anyway, and all of that winds up being kind of judgment of myself in my own mind. But I'm still doing it, and so that's interestingly still, you know, having right effort. So really just the judgment is just a waste of time. And in terms of concentration, you know, I see myself saying, oh, you know, you're distracted today, or you have a distracted mind. But really, if I can concentrate on things, and if I put my mind to it,
yeah,
I can concentrate on my breath. And even though I might have swirling thoughts and you know, feelings arising, I can concentrate on my breath. I can concentrate on what you are saying. I can concentrate on what I'm actually doing if I'm working. Even if, you know, there's thoughts that come up, I can recognize that and concentrate on what I'm doing. I can concentrate on what people are saying without listening, without getting distracted by what's coming up that I want to say in response to what they're saying. So if you have a distracted mind, you might not see all that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, that's been my experience with how concentration is improving.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's so important to recognize it. In fact, you said it beautifully. If you hadn't developed a level of concentration, you wouldn't be able to recognize that you're distracted.
Right.
And that you can do that on a sustainable and practical level is so important to recognize. It keeps you involved in your practice. The aversion that you described too is just that. And you also described not giving into it. That's so important. If we give into it, we just give it strength, don't we? Every time we feel like we don't want to meditate and don't, we're increasing that level of ignorance and that level of commitment to not meditate. And every time we do, we're diminishing it. And recognizing that aversion is simply part of one of the hindrances that even the Buddha taught all those years ago. Gives us some the right perspective. It's okay to not want to meditate and go ahead and meditate anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't have to, again, now think about how that relates to my description of an awakened human being, being fully mature human. It's an immature human being that says, I don't feel like doing that. So I'm not going to do it. And if you make me do it, I'm going to scream and holler. And a mature human being does what it does because it knows that it's skillful for it. It's helpful. And even at that level, when we feel like I don't want to do it, practice restraint and do it anyway. Why? Because of the benefits of it. Because of the benefits that you described. So, thank you. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been pretty religiously sticking to the 20 minutes twice a day, and I had a really difficult week because I have a case coming up for trial, and I put several doctors on tape. We started one of them at 8 p.m. on Wednesday, didn't end until midnight, and then I went and did it again Thursday night from 4 to 7, and it went in really well, and I noticed it progressively got better, and I was able to really concentrate and be present.
Wow.
And just, I knew where the attorney was going before he got there. I was able to object when I needed to before he even got to the words that were damaging. And a couple of times I felt like a little hint of a thought, and I go, all right, you got to refocus. And I was able, and it was great, and I think meditation has a lot to do with that. But when I was sitting here, I just started to think, did I ask this question? And I couldn't remember. And it's a foundational question that, you know, is like the centerpiece. I may have asked 4 hours of great questions, but if I didn't ask this one, everything could be down the tubes.
and it sabotaged my whole meditation today.
Wow.
Because I felt this wave of anxiety come through my body, you know, and like, oh shit, do I have to do this over? Do I have to pay this guy over? I spent hours and hours preparing him, and I was just like panicked. And so I did not have a good meditation. And it was helpful to hear you say, you know, that you don't have to approve, but you can accept. So I'm trying to accept.
Wow.
But sometimes it's not easy when something happens that just pulls your life, you know, potentially in a new direction. And I'm thinking, you know, I want to call people, I want to research. Like, you know, I almost thought of getting up and leaving, but so I'm hanging in.
Wow.
So those things happen, but, you know, I try to, like, take, I was taking the big picture. I'm going, all right, is this going to matter a year from now? Is this going to matter 5 years from now? You know, that kind of thing. But some things I think are just really powerful.
Yeah.
That's a powerful one.
That is.
I don't quite know how to deal with it.
And thank you for just bringing it up. And when it happened, you did your best to come back to your breath.
Yeah, well, it wasn't good.
And
it might have been my best.
But you also described it as something that you had a strong... You wanted the situation to be different. It's not unreasonable to want the situation to be different.
Or to find answers.
Or to find answers. But in the moment, needing it to be different proved to be a strong distraction. But you were able to frame it properly, too. You described the nature of dukkha. And when the Buddha describes the first noble truth as dukkha occurs, that's what he's referring to. As a consequence of having a human life, dukkha will occur. And when it occurs in a way that we want things to be different, in this case you wish you remembered a question, it affects us in a negative way. It creates stress. It creates dukkha. You had the entire experience of dukkha arising and slightly passing away in a meditation session. That's profound. And you had the right framework for it. Is it okay if I ask you a personal question?
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay when I say that, it's okay to say no, I'll ask you to leave, but it's okay. And again, if it's too personal, you'd rather not talk about it. It's certainly okay to say, you know, I want to keep it to myself. I remember the first phone call when you called me, and it's now maybe 2.5 years later.
Boy, it's probably 3 or 4.
Is it? Well, there's my memory. Can you describe the impact that your overall Dhamma practice has had on your life?
Amazing. Yeah, because when I called you, I was really suffering pretty badly with anxiety and depression.
And now?
And now I'm pretty good at managing it.
Yeah, that's the point I'm getting at. The practical benefits of this. That's why the Buddha
taught it. It was so bad that I had like physical stuff going on and all that. It took a year to shake it.
Yeah.
And I haven't had it since.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
And again, that's why we do it.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have a good mind frame for life or work or managing stress.
And again, you're not... That's understandable. That's the world we live in. That's the same. The Buddha didn't awaken and then blame everybody else for how deluded they were or how unawakened they were. Read that, what we started tonight's class with. The Buddha taught out of great compassion because he saw that the suffering in the world was unnecessary. The confusion that we have is unnecessary. But there's something that we necessarily have to do to change that. And the reason why I put Anthony on the spot is he did what he had to do to go from one way of looking at the world to another. So thank you, Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm happy to have done it without medications.
Yeah, and you should be. You know, think of how many people, and that's not to say that medication should never be used. It should be. There's a right place for everything. The middle way would teach us that, but there's so many people that once they, and I see them all the time, once they get on medication, it's so difficult to get off. You're very fortunate.
Yeah, just hoping it works out well, but I have to, you know. I mean, that's like I think, I don't think I know I made a mistake, I just don't remember, and that, like, panicked me.
Really?
Because I started going through the what-ifs.
You asked a good question, a rhetorical question, will this matter in a year? It won't. But it's important to what's going on as life unfolds.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I try to put things into perspective. Like, is this going to... Yeah. It could be a lot worse. Like, it could be... You know, I could have a terrible disease or, you know, I mean...
Yeah.
In the stream of life, it's not that important. But right now, it's very important.
Yeah.
It just seems that way.
And the truth of the situation is you asked 4 hours of very important and skillful questions.
Great. That's one of the most frustrating things about it. It went in so well. If I have to do it over again, it would be devastating. Yeah.
And yet there's still a little dukkha there.
And the defense attorney was pretty relentless.
Yeah. Thank
we'll
you.
See.
Jay, good to see you this morning.
Thanks. Good to see you, everybody. I guess I've always been a meditator, whether I thought it was, you know, specifically meditation or not. I've always been a cogitator, another word maybe. This week, right at the beginning of the week, I was picking on myself about some of the things I did that I wasn't quite happy with. And right first thing I said, this week, I'm specifically going to be compassionate with myself. I'm going to take it easy on myself. I'm not going to beat up on myself with stuff. This morning I got in the car and I left the window wide open on the other side. Overnight, the seat was soaked and everything else was soaked. And instead of jumping around, flipping out, I just, you know, I turned the heat up to dry it out and stuff happens, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, get all mad at myself that what an idiot, you know, I left the window open on a rainy night, you know. It happened.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing fancier, and
thank
I guess
you.
That's a good thing. I've set up my life over the years. I guess some people go through life and they let situations throw them around and do things to them, and
yeah.
I realized pretty early on that you can have a lot of control. You know, I didn't like working in a big company, so I started my own little company where I could do what I wanted to do more of the time than not. So, you know, I've always, you know, maybe taken more control of my life than people realize that you can. You know,
mm-hmm.
Some people just go through being like a pinball machine, being zapped around all over the place. And I stopped that pretty early. It wasn't always, you know, didn't always lead to serenity of any kind, but, you know, less hassle maybe.
Yeah. Thank you. Glad you're here this morning. Becky, good to see you.
Good to be here. Really good to be here. Well, my meditation is not going as well as it should. I have difficulty meditating when I go away, and I've been away for 2 weeks with a lot of stuff going on. And I just didn't meditate during that time. And when I came back, what I learned is how important it is to meditate, because I felt like I really regressed sort of to a place, almost to the place where I was when I first came here. And so I'm really happy to be back. And this meditation today was good. So I know that I'm on my way back to developing a good practice. And I did notice, or I really should say Jen noticed, that the practice has helped me not to put myself in the way of myself as much as I normally would do when I'm with my family. I was able to see things more clearly from a more compassionate perspective than I have in the past. So I know it's helping me. It's just that the week that I've been back has not really been auspicious. So I'm really happy to be back to class, and I'm happy to go away feeling that things are going to be getting on the right track again.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you were in class today. It's great to be able to recognize the inauspiciousness of a particular week arises from a lack of meditation practice. So, good for you. There's so many people that you know, maybe everyone in this room would say the same thing, that go away on a trip, whether it's business or pleasure, and find it hard to continue their practice. You're in a different environment. Sometimes it's just it doesn't seem like there's a practical place to benefit. I mean, to meditate, to just kind of get away. There's always bathrooms with locked doors. So those are good places to do. Yeah, but it is it's a common problem. But when you look at it from the perspective that we gain from developing a meditation practice, it will only enhance our business or pleasure trips, won't it, if we maintain our meditation? Even if it's less, even if it's just with five. If we're away with another person or a family or a group, sometimes it's hard and you feel that it's rude to say, I need 5 minutes for myself. But, you know, people should be willing to give you 5 minutes. Maybe 20 minutes or a half an hour is too much to expect, but we can continue. And we can always pick it up when we come back. So I'm glad you did, and I'm glad that your wise daughter pointed out that. Lisa, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks, John. Good to be here.
Glad you're here.
Meditation is great, and I should do more. I meditate every day, usually not 20 minutes, but shorter. And the earlier I do it, the better it is for the entire day. To start the day off that way. It's hard to explain what it does or why it does it, but it's calming, and there's just more of an acceptance of what the day, whatever the day is.
Yeah.
For the second, well, it's easier. Like if I leave my next to the bed, I just have this blanket that I sit on like this. And if I leave it there, and when I come up to bed, if it's there, I'll sit on it for a couple minutes to meditate. I remember, like, oh, I'm supposed to do it a second time. You know,
yeah.
It's usually only once. I know it's gotten into my head that I think I'm not as angry and explosive, although I have my moments. And I don't know why, but it has something to do with why this works.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And that's the important thing, not trying to figure out why it works. We can understand it works because this is what an awakened human being taught. That's enough for me, you know, to give it some credence. But the Buddha always said, "Ehipasiko, come and see for yourself," meaning you have to have the experience to understand that it does work. And so having the thought that I'm calmer, I don't explode as much, is important to recognize that it works. Again, this is a common problem, the second sit. You know. One of the things that I also suggest is to make it around 12 hours later in the day from your first sit, thinking that most of us sit when we first get up. So for me, it's 5 or 5:30 and then 5 or 5:30 late in the day, because I'm usually home around that time so I can do it, rather than right before we go to bed. Because that thinking that I'll meditate before I go to bed is, it's just too easy to say I'm too tired, I'm going to bed, and I'll do it tomorrow. And another thing is that having that 12-hour balance. If we schedule that second session for earlier in the day, maybe it's as soon as we get home, if we go out to work, or right after dinner, but it's best to try and fit it in before we go to bed as part of a bedtime ritual, because then it usually just falls aside as we're too tired. So important. And again, the sitting for 15 minutes a day is outstanding. There's no reason, especially at first, and I'll talk to Scott a little bit more about this, that we need to feel, since we sit here for 30 minutes or 20 minutes, that we must sit for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. when we're first starting out, we start out with shorter periods and gradually build up. And every one of us here has done that, I think, so, successfully. Thank you. Scott, welcome to our Sangha. I know you're just joining in, so I don't expect you to understand everything we're talking about, but please ask any questions or make any comments you have. How was your meditation this morning with us?
This is the longest I've meditated.
Yeah.
I started with earlier in the week with 5 minutes with the recordings on.
Oh, good.
That you had, and it seemed like 5 hours when I first started.
Yeah.
5 minutes was so long. But then I realized 10 minutes was better, so I've been doing 10-minute meditations, only once a day, though. But this is the longest I've had, and it was great. The problem I'm having is physically my back gets very sore,
mm-hmm.
and my legs ache. So a lot of my meditation is concentrating on dealing with the pain of sitting and then bringing my breath back. But I think that'll get better with time. It's gotten better since I started.
Yeah, the getting more comfortable with the posture will.
Yeah, exactly.
It's outstanding that you're already doing a 10-minute meditation, and I'm glad you're using the guided
right.
meditations on the website. One of the things that being part of a Sangha is, the reason why it's so important is that we support each other, and just having a place that at least once a week you know that you're going to meditate with 30 minutes and it's going to be part of a group makes it much easier to do it, I think. So don't feel like you have to meditate for 30 minutes right off the bat. I always say in classes, beginning a meditation practice with shorter periods of time, but consistently, and if you can do it twice a day, is much more effective in developing a meditation practice than thinking that right off the bat I have to sit for 30 minutes or longer. It just doesn't work. As far as adding the second sit, again, don't feel if you're sitting for 10 minutes now, don't feel that second sit has to be for 10 minutes. Even start with just a couple minutes. But now is the best time to start and start making that a part of your habit too, doing it twice a day. So, and as you can hear, there's more to learn about a meditation practice within this broader framework of the Eightfold Path, but that takes time. But it doesn't take lifetimes. You know, fairly quickly, you'll start understand the verbiage that I use. You'll understand how it fits, and you'll understand the context. But it takes a little bit of time. So
10 weeks
takes a yeah. awakening in 10 weeks.
But yeah,
you know, honestly, by the end of this series of classes based on the Truth of Happiness book, you will have a strong understanding of the foundational teachings of the Buddha, and you'll have enough to build a lifetime of practice on. Which is, to me, that's remarkable. Not because I wrote the book, because those teachings are still here today, you know, and they work. They really work. So, thank you, and again, welcome to our Sangha, Scott. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be here. I mean, last week I spied on you.
Oh,
don't come into class remotely.
Mm-hmm. How did that work?
It worked out great.
Great.
Great, yeah.
Thanks. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah, I was able to do the full meditation with you and listen to the lecture and listen to the comments, and that went very well.
Great.
I just could not bring myself to walk the dog that early.
Oh, it wasn't that cold.
Yeah,
it was. It was zero. Now I understand.
I'll take both of us a break here.
Yeah.
My meditation has kind of shifted off the rails. I had gone away with the kids at Christmas time and you know, completely fell off the rails, and I'm trying to get back to it. My life's been more distracted. My mother is in the process of dying, and that's really, you know, got everybody tied up in a knot, but I really need to get back to it because I think it'll help me to deal with everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm so glad you made it this morning, and it was... Don't do it again, but it was a wise choice to stay home last week. My mom died about, it's awful, I don't remember exactly how many years, but I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago. And she really suffered. She had 10 years of decline, and the end was really awful. And as you were talking, I remember that I happened to visit her the day that she passed. And it was awful to see someone you love, especially your mother. I don't want to get too graphic about what she was going through even at the end. But I was so grateful that I was able to stay mindfully present for this, where everybody, including, you know, meaning my family, everybody around me was just going, they were going crazy, and understandably so. And it was certainly wasn't pleasant, but it's still one of the most profound experiences I've ever had in my life, to be able to just stay there with it and not need it to be any different. And hopefully it'll be that way for you. I'm sorry to hear that. It's never pleasant.
I've been able to accept what's going on, but one of my sisters called me totally rattled me to the point where blocked her number because I am not.
Yeah.
I don't need to take on her craziness. And I have four other sisters who are willing to take it. I have three other sisters that are willing to take it on.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's only so much I can handle.
Yeah, and good for you and for recognizing that, you know. So, good. I'm glad you're here this morning. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you. I meditate half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the evening.
Show off.
And I don't actually duck out of meditation because I've come to realize that you never know what's going to happen in meditation anyway.
Right.
You think, like, you're distracted and think, this is not going to work today. Once you sit and your mind quietens down, you just don't know. And sometimes you can think you're going to have a good meditation and you don't. So it's just not predictable. My meditation is just not predictable. So I don't, the thought of meditation and ducking out of meditation, it's not really anything I have to deal with because I understand you don't know. I find more and more I come to the practice of realizing, oh, by the way, on Tuesday it was very beneficial for me to hear you say that part of coming back to your breath is to recognize that you're distracted to start with.
Okay.
Is really what we're doing, and coming back to the breath is just to put you in the moment again,
yeah.
To bring you back into
That's
the
right.
present time. The important thing is to recognize that you are on a story, or your mind's in the past, your mind's in the future or something.
Yeah.
You're not in the present. So you flipped it on Tuesday. And hearing you say that made a lot of sense and made it clearer to me.
Yeah, good.
And obviously you need to come up to follow what happens on the cushion into real life. I feel that I'm more able to catch my thoughts during the day when I'm not present. And just realize I'm not present, come back to the breath.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times a day I do that. Lots and lots. But it's just, what is now part of my practice to do that, part of my mental thought to do that. Sometimes all this thinking can get a bit on top of me. And life can get a bit serious. So sometimes I just give myself a break and I let it go for a day, something like that. But I get the need or the want or the desire or whatever to promote my own practice brings me back onto it again. So I'm not off it too much. And then kind of went a bit out on a limb on Tuesday and said that my feelings are, you know, my very excited feelings have been very happy and very sad. They're sort of coming together in the middle and I'm more mainstream and things like that. One of the odd things that you say from time to time is that your mind is looking for a distraction and it's because there's nothing going on. Well, it's because there's nothing going on, you know, and you have to realize sometimes that there is nothing going on. There's no distraction.
Yeah.
There's nothing going on. And I'm beginning to realize that there's nothing going on much more in my life than I thought there was going on before.
There's a whole lot of nothing going on.
That's it. And when you're doing something, you're just doing that, but there's nothing going on outside of that. So you can, it's hard to describe, you know what I mean? But
I do.
It
sounds wonderful.
There's nothing going on more often than I thought there was nothing going on.
There's always nothing going on. Thank you. So what you're describing is developing an impersonal view of life. When you've established yourself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs and is occurring, then there's a lot going on because you're everywhere.
Right.
The Buddha talks about that. You're here, there, you're everywhere.
Yeah.
That, he's talking about that as a way of distracting yourself. You've established yourself in everything. when you stop doing that, you realize that there's nothing occurring that you need to take personal or that you need to monitor in any certain way. It's just life occurring. Why take any of it personal? It simply doesn't matter. There's never anything going on that I need to be disturbed about in any inappropriate way. That doesn't mean that as we develop an awakened, fully mature human mind, we respond to things in appropriate and skillful ways. We think what's skillful in the moment, what's appropriate in the moment. But that's it, because we're not taking any of it personally. The other thing, and I'm going to put you on a spot a little bit if it's okay with you. You described developing a meditation practice now where you're meditating 30 minutes twice a day, and at sometimes you feel like you just don't want to meditate or whatever is arising, but you meditate anyway. Mm-hmm. The only way you were able to develop a 30-minute practice twice a day is to apply that same skillful view when you were still meditating for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes a day and didn't want to meditate, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And every time you said, I don't feel like meditating, but now's the time to meditate, mm-hmm. you were able to deepen your concentration. Excuse me for putting words in my mouth. Please say this is not true if it's not true. Which allowed you to broaden your understanding of the framework of the Eightfold Path as the framework for your life and to gradually increase your meditation sessions. It was synergistic or almost a requirement to do it that way. The Buddha didn't teach just meditation, obviously. He taught an Eightfold Path for his entire teaching career. And he taught it for a very specific reason. Meditation alone, and I see this in so many people, meditation alone will likely only continue to condition a conditioned mind. Why? Because it doesn't have any framework for recognizing its own conditioned or deluded thinking. You don't have the Eightfold Path. And I know many people that meditated themselves into some pretty deep psychoses because they didn't really have the framework of understanding what was occurring. But within the right framework, we're able to recognize it. Lisa.
Well, this word popped into my head when Lorna was talking. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I thought of the word invested. When things are happening, it's like she's saying she's not, you know, you're doing something and you invest, like, your whole life in it. If things go wrong, if things go right, like you invest it, you know, make it permanent, that this is, you know, this is the way it should be, rather than taking it a little lighter and not.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can describe it, but I just thought of, like, you're investing yourself in the moment as though it's the most important thing in the world. You know, instead of just saying, this is just happens to be what I'm doing right now. It's good or it's bad or it's whatever.
Yeah.
And taking it a little bit lighter. Now, I don't know if this applies. Well, I hope it's okay. There's a couple of things I was going to put up on your bulletin board, but I haven't gotten around to it. I hope that's okay.
Depends what it is.
Okay. All right.
Honestly, depends what it is. If it's related to the Dhamma, it's fine. If it's not, it's not.
Well, one was this, H. L. Macon. Does anybody?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I know exactly who that. I mean, I recognize the name. But there's something like this. This is here, and this is now, and all other human knowledge is moonshine. There's something like that. And the way I thought about that was related to Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That idea of, you use the word invested and how that can create tension in the moment. Another word for that would be conditioned thinking. You know, we are invested in protecting our conditioned views. That's really the problem. And so we create these strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. Out of that, out of our self-investment in anatta, in a wrong view of self. And that's really what leads to all the problems. Thank you for bringing that up. It's very insightful. Debbie, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you.
Well, I don't really remember the original question.
Yeah, I don't either. So. How's your meditation practice? Have you noticed it deepening your concentration, and how does it relate to the Eightfold Path or support the Eightfold Path?
So, I'm still just pretty much doing the once a day meditation practice, which is usually about 15, 20 minutes. And when Diane was talking about things coming up, I was thinking, well, I don't have any things coming up except for distracted thoughts and feelings. And I'm always just constantly trying to refocus, and that's my work, you know. It's being aware of the distraction and come back to the breath, be aware of the distraction. I think that that has helped me, even though it's very frustrating in the moment. I'm just trying to accept that it's frustrating.
Yeah.
And that's one of those thoughts that's distracting. You know, that's one of those feelings, I should say, frustrated, so that I just come accept the feeling and come back to the breath. So that, and the, you know, I've talked about this before, it's partly my work schedule at night, so that I, you know, I haven't been good about trying to try to evening meditation or afternoon. But I'm seeing that I have some resistance, and I could try to do that more. And I guess I, you know, sometimes I'll at work, I'll have a chance to do some reading, your book, or, you know, and that's helpful. Sometimes instead of a second meditation, to just keep me on track a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
So reading your book has been comforting, and this is getting back into the class, and I think that I'm, you know, the more, since the last couple weeks when I'm back into the reading too, that feeling the benefit in terms of the more about recognizing the eye making. You know, like just today, like when people were talking, and I was like really wanting to focus and listen, which I did, I chose to do, but there's a part of me that's like, well, I want to remember what I want to say about that. And then I thought, well, that's just eye making. It doesn't matter what I want to say about that. What's important is to learn and listen.
Yeah.
You know? So, and sometimes I feel like, it's kind of like what you were saying, that, you know, it's like I really don't need to talk at all sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the point of having conversations? So much of them is about eye making.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, sometimes I think, well, what can you talk about?
Yeah.
It's just hysterical. Like,
it is.
To have that insight that, yeah, so much of life is just irrelevant conversation.
Yep.
And to just kind of...
To clarify, well, what I said, most of the backups I did were for other people that they were talking about. So it's like, oh yeah, you were talking about that. Let me back you up there. That's just funny.
Right. So anyway, I'm just trying to be more aware of that. I mean, especially in terms of compassion for other people, and that that's much more important than what I have to say, and that I just really want to be more there for other people, and that's the awareness. That's what I feel like I'm benefiting from right now.
Yeah.
That all makes sense.
It all makes sense. Thank you, Debbie. The that idea of recognizing the absurdity of engaging in constant idle chatter is so important, because the world runs on that. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, just have normal conversations, but we should be mindful that we don't always have to be talking or encouraging other people to talk. We can sit quietly. We do it here all the time, don't we? It's okay to sit quietly and not say anything. If there's nothing really useful to say, why not? Why continue the distraction of idle chatter? That's why right speech is so important. And then to get back to that second sit, it is so important. One way that some people find it easier to begin that second sit is if they're sitting for 10 minutes in the morning and they don't feel they have the time, cut the 10 minutes into 5 minutes and have 2 5-minute sessions. You're not actually taking more time out of your busy day, but you are developing a second sit. That really is. And even if it's 5 minutes, split it up into 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes. And then gradually add time to each session rather than strive for 1 20-minute session and no second session. It's much more effective practice that way. Thank you, Debbie. I'm glad you're here. Diane, good to see you this morning.
It's good to be here. I think I'm really now kind of distracted all over the place trying to figure out if I have anything to say. I'm really grateful for the practice. I whether anybody would attest to it or not or affirm it or not, I know that this has changed my life. For 25, maybe 30 years, I was going to meditations in this church that I was attending, and it was a unity church, and it was, you know, kind of like a real meditation, but nobody ever explained to me what meditation was all about. And I know that I have struggled greatly, and I don't know whether that's fully in the past tense, because I have studied a number of various religions or sects or denominations or spiritual ways. When I came to this, my mind was all over the place trying to connect dots. Oh, this one works here, this one works here. Oh, that's what they were saying. Okay, this works. I'm going to kind of just encapsulate the whole thing. When I was reading, I think I was reading ahead on the Mind of Four Foundations. Anyway, so in there it said, I'm making, conceit. And a light went off. And I understood what I'm making meant, but as conceit, it just kind of whoosh, was a rush of I just am grateful that you have taken the time to be here Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays and whatever other days you were doing for a while. It's just, I think sometimes, and this is not to over-compliment or anything like that, you have exemplified more of what I've sought or something in a teacher. And I just really appreciate the effort that you put into it, the devotion you put into us and developing the time for us to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind words, Diane. I really do appreciate it. It's by reading how the Buddha taught that I learned what I do know about teaching, however effective it is. In that line that he said, it's out of compassion. It's not out of any other reason. You know? Because if it is out of any other reason to be the most well-known meditation teacher or to have the biggest sangha or anything else like that, it's so against the Dhamma, isn't it? Even though that's a lot of what modern Buddhism is. If you look at the labels applied to different schools and sects and teachers, you just see it that way, the biggest and the best. And it's just not that way. You know, the Buddha taught a very simple Dhamma, and it should be taught in a very simple way, shouldn't it? Because it is. Here's the way I'll say it. To me, it's the most important teaching available in the world today. I mean, I just think it is. But that's enough. It doesn't have to be any more than that. I don't have to embellish it or portray it, and we don't have to see it as anything other than that. One of the underlying things that we've talked about today, and in the Sangha, is just the suchness of doing it. Just doing it. Lorna was talking about that. She built up a very successful meditation practice by just doing it, despite the resistance and the aversion, the distractions of life, the difficulties of life, whether we fall out of practice for a couple of weeks because we're on vacation or not, we just do it. And we don't do it because I say you should do it, or the Buddha says you should do it, or God says we should do it. You do it because you realize the effectiveness and the skillfulness in your own life. That's an aspect of gentleness, isn't it? We're doing it because we care about ourselves. And we're doing it because we care about other people enough too, to finally awaken, to stop contributing like the Buddha did when he first walked out of the palace. Did it out of great compassion. Any other questions about the first chapter in Shamatha Vipassana Meditation or anything else we talked about today? Okay. I think I mentioned Tuesday and probably Thursday that the next study is on the four foundations of mindfulness. I believe the next chapter in the book is on the Four Noble Truths. So you'll read that, and we'll talk about that next week, and I'll give a talk on that. And I will have the... I will have the registration for our May retreat, May 17th to the 20th, online next week. So you can, and hopefully you'll be joining us, and you can sign up as soon as you can. The next chapter, I think it's okay. I wrote the book. I should know, but I think it's on.
Four foundations.
The next chapter.
For the Four Noble Truths, I think.
Is it? Well, here.
I think you're right.
We can find out.
Are you skipping around week two?
No, we're going to week two.
Yeah.
Huh?
Week two.
Four foundations of mind.
Okay, whatever it is, we're on week two. all right, let's finish with our metta meditation, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class, and thank you all online. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.